thank you everyone for coming. A few years ago, I heard a really inspiring story from Morenu Rav Shechter Shlita, that he was getting off of a flight and his son Rav Shai Shechter went to go pick him up. And he asked him a question on either the 3 weeks or the 9 days. One of those periods of time had just begun. And Rav Shechter said he didn't know the answer to the question. And Rav Shai was obviously surprised, because Rav Shechter knows the answer to almost all questions. He knows all of, you know, Torah. And he said, like, Abba, I'm surprised you don't know the answer. And Rav Shechter said, to be honest, I never learn in Yanei 3 weeks. I never learn in Yanei 9 days, because every year I'm so hopeful that we won't have to do it again. And now we're here and I'm not prepared, because I didn't think it was going to happen. So on like a less serious note, I think that was what the camp had in mind when they asked me like 12 hours ago to speak. They didn't think we would get to this point. They didn't think we'd have the 3 weeks or the 9 days. And we were hopeful that we wouldn't have that. So at the last second, they realized it looked like it was going to happen. So they asked someone to give a shiur, and I was the only one who responded that I'd be able to do it. So here we are. But on a more serious note, I also don't usually prepare so much for the 3 weeks or the 9 days for that exact reason. In part, maybe it's because of procrastination, but in reality, it's really because, like, I don't want to think about it. And I don't want to have to, you know, confront the possible reality of going through another year of the 3 weeks and another year of the 9 days, and hopefully not this year, another year of Tisha B'Av. And I wanted to talk about just some reasons why we mourn on Shavuot Sefer Tammuz, and maybe some ha'aras and ideas on how we hopefully won't mourn in the future. And the biggest reason why I did this is because, to be honest, I don't really know a whole lot about Shavuot Sefer Tammuz, or at least I didn't. So I literally just did research on, like, why do we fast on Shavuot Sefer Tammuz. I knew there were 5 reasons. I didn't even know what they were. It's a Mishnah and Tinus. And we're going to list those 5 reasons and then some other more abstract reasons for why I think we fast on Shavuot Sefer Tammuz. So the first reason listed among the 5 reasons in the Mishnah and Tinus is the breaking of the Luchos. Moshe Rabbeinu broke the Luchos. We know who broke the Luchos after the Chet HaEgel. They thought Moshe was coming down. They miscounted. Moshe hadn't come down yet. And they lost all hope. And they built a golden calf. If I could just go on a tangent for a second, one of the, I guess, pros of not preparing so much is you go on more tangents, because you just kind of think of things as you go along. And I heard a tremendous piece of Torah from that Rebbe Rav Targan. Rav Targan asks the question, why is it that the Jewish people decided to build a golden calf when Moshe Rabbeinu didn't come back? Who is the next person who would probably be in line to be leader? Aaron, right? Aaron was Moshe's brother. He was the Kohen Gadol. And they go up to Aaron and they say, Aaron, we don't have a leader. And Aaron's like, yeah. And they're like, we need someone to step in. And Aaron's probably thinking, like, okay, like, it probably would be me, because I'm the number two guy and I'm the Kohen Gadol. And they say, so can you build us a golden calf? And Aaron's probably like, what? Like, why would we build a golden calf? Like, you should have the Kohen Gadol, the person who's from the royal family, for lack of a better term, be the new leader. And the Rebbe of Targan explains that the reason why they asked for a golden calf and not for Aaron is, it's not just that they gave up on Moshe, they gave up on man, they gave up on humanity. And they felt like they needed a different way of worshiping and a different way of connecting to Hashem, because they kind of lost all faith in humanity. But number one, the first reason why we fast and we mourn on Shavuot Sefer Tammuz is because of the breaking of the Luchos. Number two is the cancellation of the Karban Tamid. The Karban Tamid is a Karban that we used to bring every single day. If there's like one thing you say in Karbanos, I know in camp it's very hard to say Karbanos, because right after Brachos, they announce you're up to Rabbi Yishmael Omer, and you're like, that was really fast, we didn't say anything. But if there's one part of Karbanos that I think that we should all say, it's a Tamid. It's because we said it every single day. There's an oft-quoted idea from the Ein Yaakov in Sagdama, where he brings up a Medrash that I think isn't actually a Medrash. The Ein Yaakov kind of just quoted it. I'm not sure where it comes from. And he asks, what's the most important pasuk in the Torah? And if I were to ask you what's the most important pasuk in the Torah, what are some ideas that you would say? V'yat l'recha k'mocha. Maybe some others? Shema. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. That's a pretty important pasuk. Maybe Anochi Hashem. Maybe Bereishis Bara Elokim. Maybe something about the giving of the Torah. Ben Azai says the most important pasuk in the Torah is that of the Karban Tamid. Why could that possibly be the most important pasuk in the Torah? That seems like a pretty mundane thing that we do every day. And the answer is that, because we do it every day, so much of our religious practice, so much of our religion, so much of Judaism is the day in, day out, and the structure that we have. And when we lost the Karban Tamid, we lost the structure of the religious experience that we knew, and that was gone. Numbers 3 through 5, I think, could all be kind of grouped together. Number 3 is there was a statue brought into the Heichal of the Beis HaMikdash. There was a Avodah Zarah brought into the Beis HaMikdash. Number 4 is somebody named the Apostomus burned a Sefer Torah. And number 5 is the walls of Yerushalayim were breached by the enemy. Both times, right, Yerushalayim was sieged, and the walls were finally breached on Shavuot Sefer Tammuz. I think those 3 things kind of represent the same thing of like it was the beginning of the end. And like when it happened, like we kind of knew it was over. There's a sports mashal I thought of. about Mariano Rivera. Mariano Rivera, for those who follow sports, was known as the best closer of all time. The closer is the guy who comes in to pitch the ninth inning in a baseball game. When it's a tight game, it's a one-run game, it's a tie game, you bring him in to kind of finish them off. And in his 22-year career, he won 5 World Series, and he only blew 4 games. There were only 4 games in his entire career in the playoffs that he came in, and they lost after he came in, showing how remarkable of a pitcher he was. And one game was the last game of the series. It was why they lost. But the other 3 games were not the final game of the World Series or the series that they were playing. But after each of his 3 blown saves, the Yankees did not win another game that series. They lost, and they were eliminated from the playoffs. And I was wondering, like, why? What's the correlation between Mariano Rivera blowing, let's say, Game 3 and the Yankees losing games 4 through 6? And I think it's kind of like this dagger that they never thought would happen. Like, he was their security blanket. He was their safety. He was the guy who, when you brought him into the ninth inning, you knew the game was over. And now suddenly they were exposed. They were vulnerable. They almost felt naked. We brought in our guy, and he lost. And when the walls of Yerushalayim were breached, the walls signify safety, walls signify protection and security. When those walls were breached, we were exposed, we were naked, we were done. And even though the Beis HaMikdash wasn't destroyed for another 3 weeks, we saw the writing on the wall. We knew it was over. And same thing for the Heichal of the Beis HaMikdash. I was talking to some of my campers earlier today, and none of them were born before 9/11, and most people in this room probably weren't born before 9/11. I was only 2 at the time. I don't remember any of it. But for my parents, and for most of our parents, it's a day that is very emotional, a day that hits. And one of the biggest reasons, in addition to the fact that, of course, 3,000 people were killed by senseless terrorism, it's that for the first time in American history, we were exposed. It was no longer the country that couldn't be stopped. It was no longer the country that couldn't be attacked and the safest place on earth. It was now a place that felt open and vulnerable. And that was a time that was very scary. And like we don't know about a time that you could kind of just walk into the plane and there isn't airport security. And we sometimes see movies of like 40 years ago and the kids kind of just like walk into the cockpit with the pilot and you're like, what is he doing? Why did he just go in? But like there used to just be a safety that America felt and it didn't exist anymore after 9/11. And I think that in some ways that's what we are mourning on Shabbat Shabbat Tam is we were exposed. We became vulnerable. And even though, of course, we know both Bat HaMikdash were only destroyed on Tisha B'Av, it was today when we saw the writing on the wall and we lost that structure. It also kind of ties in to the Tumid. We lost that structure. We lost that day-to-day, that consistency. We lost religious practice as we knew it. So those are the 5 reasons that we technically mourn on Shavuot Shavuot Tammuz. That's again from the Mishnah and Tainus. But those aren't the only reasons why we mourn. There are other reasons why we mourn. And this is, I guess, more like clawly towards the 3 weeks in general. So the first reason, were again, the 5 reasons that we stayed. And the second thing I want to talk about was how we mourn because we don't mourn. There's a story I heard, it's a little bit intense, so I'm sorry if it's sensitive to some people, but there's a story that is often told around Tisha B'Av about a couple that's trying to have kids for many years and they're having trouble and they're not successful, and finally they have a kid and unfortunately the mother dies in childbirth. And the last thing she says to her husband is just make sure our son remembers me, just make sure our son knows that, you know, he had a mother, even though I'm not going to be there for his journey, I'm not going to be there for his life. And every stage of life is so, you know, so bittersweet because the bris represents the end of Shiva, and the Pidyon HaBen represents the Shloshim, and each year his birthday is the Yahrzeit. And finally, it's his Bar Mitzvah. And some people say that a Katan could say Kaddish before they turn 13, but in this case, they didn't hold by that, I guess. Again, the technicalities of the story is less important. But he turns 13, and he's getting ready for his Bar Mitzvah. And he's going to say Kaddish on his mother's Yahrzeit for the first time. And anticipating the Kaddish, the entire shul is emotional. The entire shul is distraught. The entire shul is crying because they knew this mother. And this represents, her Yahrzeit. And finally, the son gets up to say Kaddish. Without any emotion in his voice, he goes, Yiskadal, Yiskadash, Me'rabah. And again, everyone in the shul is crying. And this kid has no emotion in his voice. And everyone's wondering, like, why is this kid not emotional? It's his mother's Yahrzeit. And then they realized he didn't know his mother. Everyone else in the shul knew the mother. They were sad. But this kid had no relationship with the mother. It was just a story. It was just a history. It was just something in the past. Another story that I think kind of sheds a light on this idea comes from 1967 when we recaptured the old city in the Six-Day War. So many of the Chayalim who were part of the brigade that recaptured the old city were Dati, they were religious Jews. There were some who weren't, though. And as you can imagine, if you're a religious Jew and you hadn't had access to Har Bayis in 2,000 years, it'd be a pretty emotional moment to refine the Beis HaMikdash. So most of these Chayalim were crying and were overcome with emotion. And there was one Chayal who was not religious by any stretch of the imagination, was really far, arguably even anti-religious, and he was also crying. And one of his religious friends, one of his religious co-soldiers, turned to him and said, "Why are you crying?" And he said, "I'm crying because I'm not crying. You guys are all crying because you feel a connection to this. This means something. This matters. The fact that we're recapturing the Kotel is relevant and important and significant. To me, it's not. I know it should be, but it doesn't matter. And for that reason, I'm crying." So the biggest reason why I cry on Tisha B'Av and during the 3 weeks is because I'm not crying. I'm sad we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. I would like a Beis HaMikdash, but I don't know what it means to not have a Beis HaMikdash. We don't have, you know, we don't have any exposure to that. We don't have any access to that. We don't know anyone who knows anyone who knows anyone who's seen the Beis HaMikdash. It was 2,000 years ago. It doesn't mean a whole lot to us. But we mourn because we want it. But again, it's hard for us to connect. So I think one of the biggest reasons that we mourn during the 3 weeks is because we don't mourn. And we cry because we don't cry, and we're sad because we're not sad. And just to kind of talk about the 3 weeks in general, because again, Shavuot Bar Tam is kind of the kickoff to the 3 weeks, I want to talk about why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. So the two Batei HaMikdash were destroyed for different reasons. The Gemara and Yoma and Daf Tesam Beis list them. And the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Anyone know for what reasons? Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, and Shvichas Damim. These are commonly known as the big three. These are the three Averos that you die for instead of committing. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says that there's the pasuk of V'chai Behem, we should live and not die by the mitzvos. So normally, if someone puts a gun to your head and says, you know, eat a piece of pig, or eat some pork, you would do it. But there are three things that you would not, that you would take the bullet for. If it's Avodah Zarah, if it's Gilui Arayos, illicit relations, or if it's Shvichas Damim, murder. Those are the three reasons why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. And Rabbi Jack Hartstein, he's the Nitzi Chenochet, he was talking to the older Shtili and the Elon Note campers yesterday in the Merkaz. Yes, some of you guys may have been there. I'm sorry for repeating, but it was a really powerful point when he made it. And I had thought about it before. We had actually spoken about it before, but it really struck a chord with me. We're probably thinking when we hear those things, okay, we don't do that. Again, I don't know everyone in the room personally, so it's possible that there are murderers here, but like, I don't think so. Like, Morissette does their background checks. They usually try to, you know, make sure there are no murderers here. Hopefully no one's doing Gilui Arayos, and most people don't really have a tie but to bow down to idols nowadays. So we're probably thinking, like, I don't know, like, that's not really so relevant to us. But when Jack was talking yesterday, he challenged us, and he said, are you sure? Are you sure you guys don't do any of these things? Avodah Zarah is not just worshiping idols, it's worshiping anything foreign to Hashem. And he challenged the campers, and he said, who here worships LeBron James? Don't show me your hands. And kids don't always follow instructions so well, and they all raise their hand. I worship LeBron James. Just like, I didn't need to know that. But they're saying, like, in reality, they worship basketball, and they worship these NBA stars. And then he turned to another side of the room, who maybe are less inclined by basketball players, and he said, who here worships, and he didn't really know a lot of celebrities, so pick a random celebrity or pop star. And they all raised their hand. They're like, yeah, honestly, I do. I want to be like him. I want to be like her. I pine to be like that person. So is it really true they don't have any Avodah Zarah? But I don't think that's really the Avodah Zarah that probably strikes this crowd. The kind of crowd that's coming to a shir, you know, 17 hours into a fast are probably not the people who are worshiping LeBron James. But I think we might struggle with our own sense of Avodah Zarah, because there is the aspect of Avodah Zarah of worshiping ourselves. And sometimes we get caught up in gaiva, we get caught up in arrogance, we get caught up in our ego. And we want to be, you know, that guy or that girl. We want to be the counselor. So maybe we do things that put down our co. Or we want to be, you know, the center of attention, so we'll go in at the expense of another person. We'll make a joke that makes another person feel bad, which kind of leads to Shvichas Damim, which we'll get to in a minute. Is it really true that we don't do any Avodah Zarah? Is it true that we have no arrogance, no ego, and that everything we do is for Hashem? I'm not giving muster to you guys, I'm really giving muster to myself, because I know for myself that I do, quote-unquote, that type of Avodah Zarah. And it's scary, it's something we need to work on. There are other forms of Avodah Zarah. One of my friends interned for this guy who did, like, this guy wanted to work with, like, other religions and other religious leaders to get together, and he did his internship for this, I guess, like a multi-religious group. And there's a rabbi who was interviewing a pastor. He's the chief priest of Compton. I guess he's like the chief rav of Compton. Compton, for those who don't know, is one of the worst cities in terms of crime rate. So this guy, he has a really tough rabbanus that he's dealing with. And the rabbi was interviewing this priest, and the priest was saying, you know, the temple was destroyed because of idolatry. And he said, and I tell my congregants every single week on Sunday, you guys do idolatry. You guys worship money. You guys worship riches. You guys worship, you know, whichever side of the political spectrum you are, you worship that politician or that political party. Like, don't think that because you're not bowing down to an idol, you're not doing Avodah Zarah. And I think it's an important thing for us to consider as well. Now, with regards to Shvichas Damim, so the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that embarrassing someone is just as bad as killing someone. And I alluded to it earlier. I think a lot of us probably fall victim to this. And it's very hard not to. you know, make a funny joke that puts down someone else, and we want, and we're not doing it maliciously necessarily. Most people here probably aren't mean, but sometimes we do, you know, make a joke at someone else's expense and embarrass them. And I think we've all probably been in experiences, maybe it's a summer in camp, maybe it's a different context, where like our day or our week or our experience was literally ruined by one comment that one person made. And that objectively doesn't make sense. Objectively, if 99% of what's going on is good, and there's one negative comment, that shouldn't really ruin our day, but we all know it does. We've all been there when that one person made that comment that rubbed us the wrong way, or they hit that spot that we're really self-conscious about, and we didn't think they would know. Just again, tangentially, there was a comedian, John Mulaney, and he was going on this rant about how he really doesn't like 9-year-olds, so I guess he shouldn't be a NITI counselor. But he's like, I really don't like 9-year-olds because they know how to like find that thing that you're really insecure about and bring it up. And he's very tall, so he has long legs. He's like, whenever I walk by and like there are a bunch of 9-year-olds, they're like, oh, look, it's the guy with long legs. He's like, that's the thing I'm self-conscious about. That's what I'm insecure about. Like, you got me. And we all have those things that like we're insecure about, and someone embarrasses us or makes a joke about us or makes us the center of attention in a negative way, and it really brings us down, and we need to make sure not to do it to others. It's a form of murder, according to the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, rather, and that's why we don't have the base of Mikdash again. But what I think is also really significant to look at is why the second base of Mikdash was destroyed. The first base of Mikdash was destroyed because of the big three. Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim. Those are the things you die before you do. It makes sense that the base of Mikdash would be destroyed because of that. Why was the second base of Mikdash destroyed? Anybody know? Sinas Chinam. Baseless hatred. So, you know, a basic equation would tell you that if you would need Shvichas Damim, Avodah Zarah, and Gilui Arayos to destroy the first base of Mikdash, you would need something of a similar weight and stature to bring down the second base of Mikdash. That means that Sinas Chinam is as bad as all those three things combined. And the Gemara says explicitly, it's not my extrapolation, the Gemara says that Sinas Chinam is just as bad as all three of those things. And if we're being honest, we know that Sinas Chinam still exists a lot today. In Judaism, we play identity politics. We're so into our hashkafa, our yeshiva, our seminary, our school, our camp, we put down others baselessly. I heard a really geschmack story in a shir I listened to Hawaii Torah recently. I don't remember which one. It was one of the shir I'm giving on Ein Sweat Kol recently. And there was somebody who was telling a Rebbe about this Rosh Shiva who loves Torah so much that when he walks into his base medrash at Night Seder and sees that the guys in the yeshiva are learning shtark, he starts dancing. He's so excited about the Talmud Torah going on that he starts dancing. And the Rebbe said, that guy doesn't love Torah. He loves his yeshiva. You know who loves Torah? Someone loves Torah when they walk into another base medrash, when they walk into another yeshiva and sees them learning and starts dancing. When you see someone from another yeshiva, when you see someone from another seminary, and they were successful in that institution, and we're happy for them, that's loving Torah. But when we're so into, you know, our school, our yeshiva, our institution, our hashkafa, whatever hashkafa we identify as, I'm not Orthodox, so I don't like yeshivish people, or chassidish people, or whatever it is. That's playing identity politics with Judaism, that's baseless hatred, that's the reason why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. And the Gemara goes on and says something that probably many of us have heard, that any generation that doesn't rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, it's as if we destroyed it. So this isn't just a history lesson that we're learning about how, you know, the Jews 2,000 years ago, they did Avodah Zarah, and the Jews 2,000 years ago, you know, they hated each other. It's a real Mr. Haskell that we have to look into ourselves and make sure that we're not doing it. And even though it's a fast, even though it's a very sad day, obviously there's reason to focus on the negative. It's important for us to understand why we fast on Shavuot Sefer Tammuz. It's critical that we identify with how we could properly mourn. And it's important that we realize why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. But I'm not into purely negative shiurim for the sake of being negative. I don't know that that's such a productive thing. I know some people were hoping for some serious muster, and maybe we already covered that. But I think the best muster also is positive. Positive chizuk. Someone was just talking to me, just for context, I'm the chinuched for Ilan Ot, and someone was asking me, like, do you get, like, harif with the kids? Do you, like, get, like, intense with them? And I said, like, yeah, all the time. But I always do it in a positive way. Like, I'm very much of the belief that you shouldn't call a kid a bad kid. I think it's so damaging, and I also think it's incorrect. I think instead we look at kids and ourselves as tzaddikim who make mistakes, good people who sometimes struggle, good people who sometimes falter, and not as bad kids. When you call someone a bad kid, it's self-fulfilling prophecy. They start to believe that they're a bad kid. And I think that we as a nation should also view ourselves as a good nation. Of course, we know the Jewish people are an amchei orf. We're very difficult. You know, we're not always perfect. But I think it's important that we have positive chizik, even and perhaps especially on a sad day like Shavuot Sefer Tammuz, so we can have things to really take away from and look at. So I want to talk about how we could hopefully rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. The first thing is kind of the antithesis of the second reason why I said we mourn. I said we mourn because we don't mourn, and we cry because we don't cry. I think we should really, you know, look towards something and believe that we're capable of bringing the Beis HaMikdash. There's an episode of Seinfeld. Sorry for quoting a TV show during Shabbos for Thomas here. I don't know if that's Krum. But there's an episode of Seinfeld where Kramer and George are sitting in the diner. And if you've ever watched Seinfeld, it's literally called The Show About Nothing. There's no substance to the show. They just sit around and they drink coffee and they, you know, go to the DMV and they do, you know, useless things. And it's a very funny show. But Kramer, who does the least out of anybody, and they all do nothing. So Kramer's talking to George. And they're kind of just like talking about like nonsense. And Kramer goes, George, let me ask you this. Do you yearn? And George's like, not recently. Like, I don't... He's like, but do you yearn? And George's like, no. And Kramer's like, well, I yearn. And I dream of greatness. And he's like, and that's why I'm going to LA. And he goes to LA to become an extra on TV shows. And I don't think that's the yearning we should be going for. But I think we need to yearn. We need to believe that we can achieve greatness. We need to believe that we can fly and reach the heights. And sometimes we're so content with being small. I heard a really, really amazing story from Rav David Lichtenstein, who's on the Behind the Bima podcast. And he told a story about a cab driver who he has a professional driver, and he wanted the driver to drive his son from New York to Montreal. A bit of a long drive, but it is the driver's job. And he asked the driver to drive his son to his future in-laws in Montreal. And the driver said, I can't. And David Lichtenstein said, what do you mean you can't? Like, it's part of our contract. And he said, I don't have a passport. And this driver was a 64-year-old retired cop or whatever, and he didn't have a passport. And David Lichtenstein's like, you've never left America? He said, I've never left New York. I think I left twice. I think one time I went to New Jersey for the weekends, and one time I went to Philly for a concert, but like, I've really never left, you know, the New York area. And David Lichtenstein said, at that moment, I felt like he was so small. He was just so small. And I think if we don't yearn, we fall victim of becoming small. We need to believe as a nation we could achieve great heights. I think that's embodied the best by Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is someone who I'm always inspired by, and I always want to learn from, and I always want to grow from. Rabbi Akiva started at 40. He knew nothing. He didn't know the Aleph Beis. He hated Talmid Chacham so much that he wanted to bite them like a donkey. And specifically like a donkey, because a donkey bites really hard and chews them. And he really, really hated Torah. And then he was inspired and started to change his ways at the age of 40. Now, most people, if I were to guess at the age of 40, if they were inspired, would probably say, I'm over the hill. I'm done. This isn't for me. I can't do it. But he said, no, I'm going to start. I'm going to go to Cheder. I'm going to join the kindergarten class. Not even Nitzis. I'm going to join the day camp, you know, to learn. And the remarkable thing is that he went on to become one of the greatest Talmid Chacham of all time. But if I were to guess, and I wasn't there, if I were to guess, maybe Akiva was 40 years old in one day, he was probably still in Am Aretz. He maybe knew Aleph and Beis. He probably didn't even know Gimel. And at 40 in 3 days, and 40 in 5 days, and 40 in a month, he was still in Am Aretz. He still didn't know much. Rabbi Akiva saw the big picture, and he saw that there was a chance for greatness. And it wouldn't happen today, wouldn't happen tomorrow, not in a month, and probably not even in a year. But over the course of time, Rabbi Akiva saw that he could achieve greatness. And he had to believe himself to start over later on, because we know that Rabbi Akiva's 24,000 Talmidim all died. And there's a classic question that comes up around Lag BaOmer. Why are we celebrating Lag BaOmer? So people say, because Rabbi Akiva's students stopped dying. Why did Rabbi Akiva's students stop dying? Because they were all dead. All 24,000 students were dead. That's not usually a reason to celebrate. Like, you don't celebrate that you didn't lose because you already lost. Like, he lost all 24,000 of his students. But the best answer I've heard about this is that the reason why we celebrate isn't, of course, because his students died. It's because he started over. Rabbi Akiva, again, knew nothing at the age of 40 and started to learn Torah and started to connect to Judaism and religion and Yadus, and built up an institution of 24,000 students. The biggest Torah learning institution there ever was. And it fell literally to zero in the matter of a month. And he started over with 5 students. Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Huda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua. The Gemara explains that they continued Torah. Had it not been for those 5 students, the Torah would have been lost forever. And we see that even today. Because if you ever read a Mishnah or a Gemara and you see Tana Kama, Rabbi Meir is the Tana Kama. If you ever see a Sifra that doesn't have a name on it, it's Rabbi Huda. If you've ever seen a Sefri that doesn't have a name on it, it's a Rishimun. And beyond that, these 5 Amoras are quoted constantly, or these 5 Tanan. We constantly see Rabbi Meir and Mishnah, it's Rabbi Yehuda and Gemaras, and Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon, and Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua. I heard of Tani Cohen from MTA quote that around 80% of the Gemara comes from these 5 Talmidim. So imagine if Rabbi Akiva decided to call it quits. Imagine if Rabbi Akiva said, I can't do more. I can't achieve greatness. We wouldn't have a Torah. We likely wouldn't be in this camp today. We wouldn't have yeshivas. We wouldn't have seminaries. We wouldn't have Torah. Because Rabbi Akiva said, you know what? I'm not going to listen to the haters. I'm not going to listen to the noise. I'm not going to listen to people saying that I'm done. I'm not going to give up. I'm yearning. I'm looking for greatness. And that, I think, leads into the second thing. Not only do we need to yearn, but we yearn by believing in ourselves and the klal. I mentioned that I think that each person should be looked at as a good person and not as a bad kid. And it really is so true. It was funny. There's a camper in our camp who I'm really impressed with. You know, he stays after shiur and asks questions. I see him davening with a lot of kavana, and I really, you know, think he's a wonderful kid. And I was talking to one of the counselors, and I was like, you know, this guy, we'll call him Reuven, because that's the best name you would come up with when you make up names. I said, like, I'm really impressed with Reuven. Like, I think I'm even going to, like, write one of those notes to his parents, you know, as like a nachas note, because he's just doing so well. They're like, Yoni, Reuven is put on probation this morning. Like, he's going to get kicked out of camp in a week if he doesn't step up his act. So you could say I'm naive, and you could say I'm not paying attention, but I knew that Reuven is doing all that stuff. I knew that Reuven is breaking a lot of the rules. But I also see that he's a really good guy with a lot of potential. And I think it's so easy, especially in camp, to get into the mindset of, like, he's bad, she's bad, she's not good, he's good for nothing. And we try to, like, rank ourselves also. We're like, I'm good because I'm doing this, and this counselor isn't so good because they sleep when they shouldn't be sleeping, and this camper's bad because they don't go to davening. But, like, you know, we're trying to win as a team here. We're trying to win as a community. We're trying to do this as a family. And we can only do that if we really believe in the entire klal. So again, we mourn for a lot of reasons. We mourn because we lost the structure, we lost the foundation, we lost the safety, security, and protection that we once had. And we mourn because we can't mourn. We mourn because we don't connect to it. We mourn because we don't know what it's like for the Beis Hamikdash to be destroyed. And we're not sad about it because, you know, it's not so relevant to us. But it's also important that we recognize why we actually lost the Beis Hamikdash again. Avodah Zarah Gila Arav Shfichas Damim. And moreover, baseless hatred sin aschinam. But finally, I think it'd be a mistake to walk away only with the sadness and only with the negatives and realize that just like any generation who doesn't rebuild the Beis Hamikdash destroyed it, every generation has the potential to build the Beis Hamikdash. There's like a classic thing when, like, a not-so-good sports team makes it to the playoffs and they say, like, why not us? Why can't we win the championship? Why can't we rise to the top? Why can't we win the tournament? I think that every door, you know, in Klal Yisrael needs that. Like, why not us? Why can't we bring the Beis Hamikdash? Sure, you could point at every negative going on, and you know what? You're probably right. You're probably even underestimating the amount of negative going on. All the concerns you have about your campers are probably true. But there's also so much positive going on. There's more Torah going on today than there ever has been before. There are more chesed organizations than we could possibly count. And there are a lot of really beautiful things happening in Klal Yisrael. And it starts with each of us. It starts with yearning, believing in ourselves, and most importantly, believing in Klal Yisrael. I wish you have an easy, meaningful fast.